from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Every year, from all corners of the world, millions of Muslims make the Hajj. They gather in the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia for 5 days of prayer, ritual, and reflection. It's a pilgrimage expected at least once in a lifetime for every Muslim who can afford it. A spiritual journey with roots that go back even before Muhammad. But the holy ground has changed and is changing again. Skyscrapers, shopping malls, luxury hotels. This hour on Point, the Hajj and the old and new of pilgrimage and Mecca. You can join the conversation. What's your question on the Hajj? Have you done it, made it, and what did you see, experience in Mecca? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a little sound. Ahead of the Hajj last year, Muslim pilgrims praying outside the Grand Mosque in Mecca. You get just a little sense there from the sound of the scale of the site. We're going to talk about exactly that and what's around the famous site we see in those tight shot photographs. Joining me now from New Delhi in India is Basharat Pir. He's a Kashmiri journalist, author of Curfewed Night, a frontline memoir of life, love, and war in Kashmir. He's currently working on a book about India's Muslims. His big piece for the New Yorker magazine this month is titled Modern Mecca, the Transformation of a Holy City. Basharat Pir, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure being here.
So you're Muslim and you went on the Hajj. When did you go, Basharat?
I went on the last day of October, 2011, and I arrived in Saudi Arabia on 31st October evening, and we arrived at the Jeddah airport. There's a special terminal for Hajj pilgrims, and because the crowds are so vast, we were stuck at the terminal for 13 hours. So I stepped out on the morning of November 1st. That was my first day there.
Give us a sense. There's much we want to learn here, but give us just a sense of the scale in terms of numbers of people and what goes on at the Hajj so we can begin to visualize it in our mind's eye.
Well, the numbers are anywhere between, the official numbers are 2 to 3 million people. And the ritual of Hajj, the pilgrimage happens. It's most of the action it's all packed within 1 week. So it's actually 5 days. But some people arrive a little earlier, say a week or two earlier. And the build up, the crowds just grow as you go close to the date that the Hajj formally begins. So when I landed there, it was a few days before the actual ritual of Hajj would start. And you can get a sense of that from the scene at the airport. You land there on this flight from India with a few hundred people, and we go through customs, and we're all dressed in white robes. It's just like two sheets of cloth, like two white towels wrapped around your body, and you just tie them with a black leather belt, and there's nothing else on you, and you just go through this massive terminal. It's kind of, I don't think I have even seen a bigger waiting hall at JFK. And this terminal was specially designed actually by Owings and Merrill, by this architect who designed the Sears Tower in Chicago. And he was a Bangladeshi American architect and a partner at Owings and Merrill. And it's designed as a series of these massive white tents. That's the roof, and then there's this open space. And these tents just stretch for like almost a mile. And they're all these Teflon-coated white tents. It's kind of these giant eagles spreading their wings. And anywhere you look, and pilgrims are housed according to nationality. So I was in the part of this terminal which mostly had people from India, from Pakistan, from Sri Lanka, from Afghanistan, and from Bangladesh. And everywhere I saw, there was just, it was literally a sea of white. You just see thousands and thousands of people just waiting there. And it was quite impressive because, it's such an emotional and important journey for most pilgrims that people were, I mean, you know, nobody was complaining while waiting. And it was largely resigned, or people were praying. And above, we had these invisible loudspeakers. And there's a special prayer, which is kind of the theme song of the Hajj. There's a certain chant in which you repeat throughout the journey. It goes like, Labbaik, Allahumma Labbaik. And that would be, you know, played on these invisible speakers.
So what does that mean?
I mean, well, it means that, you know, I accept, I'm here for you. I mean, literally, it means here, you know, Labbaik means here I am. Oh Allah, here I am. You have no partner. And then you repeat Labbaik, which is here I am. And, you know, all praise, grace, and sovereignty belongs to you, and that you have no partner. So essentially, it's an affirmation of monotheism, which is at the core of Islam.
Explain for us, if you'd be good enough. There's so much we want to learn here. It's really interesting in and of itself. And then your description of how the holy city is changing is really interesting, too. But just very simply, why do Muslims go on the Hajj?
Well, it's one of the... So as sort of the core elements of a religion go, it's one of the five main pillars. That's how it's been always described of Islam. First is, you know, you have to affirm your faith, then you have to pray, and there's charity that's required. You have to give a certain part of your income as sort of a divine income tax. It's called zakat. And you have to fast in the month of Ramadan. Mm-hmm. But with the Hajj, it's a special, there's a condition. Only a Muslim who can afford to make this journey is obliged to make it. Mm-hmm. And it does have a special place because, you know, it's if you think of it, Islam is a very textual religion without any visual representations of Muhammad allowed or any visual representations of God per se. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it is this place when you actually, you know, apart from the rituals, you go to this landscape, to the physical landscape of the nucleus. Okay, this is the geography from which this religion spread. I mean, most Muslims in the world today are non-Arab Muslims from the farthest corners of the world. I mean, China, Indonesia, Malaysia, all of Asia. And it's always this world that you have read about or heard about and never really seen. I mean, now we see it on TV, but actually making that journey, and people have been making that journey just to be able to see the Kaaba, which is sort of in some ways the center of the Muslim world.
This is the black curtain, this sort is the of black cube curtain at the center of the Grand Mosque.
Exactly. And that does, I mean, it's, if you think of an image, which is the most dominant image in the world of Islam, it is the Kaaba. It is this elegant black cube with this, I mean, it's a granite building. It's roughly cubic. I mean, it's not an exact cube, but almost a cube. But it's covered with this black silken drape. And that is really the dominant image. You see it in calendar art. You see it everywhere.
Sure.
And I had grown up with pictures of, you know, Kaaba on a calendar in my parents' living room.
What's in there? You've now been, it's a granite building behind the black curtain. The black curtain is replaced every year, black silk, you say. Well, most of us have never been near it. What is it? What's inside? What makes
inside,
it so holy?
It was, you know, according to Muslim belief, God commanded Abraham to build it as his house. And the Quran describes it as the sanctuary. And the Quran says that, you know, God commanded Abraham to invite people to come for the Hajj to his house. So it's referred as the sanctuary, as the ancient house, as God's house in the Quran. And as the story according to Islamic sources goes, that, you know, after Abraham established the ritual of Hajj, the ritual changed along the way. And a lot of pagan rites were mixed by the Arab tribes in it.
And this is the same Abraham as in Judaism and Christianity, Abraham and Isaac and Ishmael and the whole.
Of course, it's the same story. I mean, in some ways, you're walking through some of the landscape that's described in the book of Genesis. I mean, it's Hagar and Ishmael and Abraham. And it also sort of reminds you in this kind of politically fraught world of these shared heritages. It is the story that really starts with Abraham and Muhammad, whose descendant to Abraham through Ishmael, is following sort of his ancestor's path and renewing the pilgrimage and giving it its present shape just a few months before Prophet Muhammad died.
I want to look at, if I may, we'll come back and look at that story, but you remind us that in a religion without visual images of the Prophet Muhammad, or certainly of Allah, how would you, but this visual landscape, the Kaaba and everything around it, is important. But you're describing something here as well that's very modern, that you've got, people may not visualize this, but right above all this is now very, very large skyscrapers right next to this large pilgrimage destination.
It was actually quite shocking to be there. You know, as I said, I had read anthropologists going to Mecca, I had read Richard Burton, I had read, various other accounts by Muslim pilgrims. But in the imagination, my imagination again was dominated by this image of the Kaaba and the stories. But mm-hmm. when I went there, it looks like a modern suburb, something like the skyline of Dubai. And if a bit of Dubai has been built, it's just modernist towers towering over the ancient landscape, it just looks like a city which has been built without any sense of history or tradition. That's what modern Mecca looks like.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Muslims making the Hajj and how the holy pilgrimage ground is being remade in Mecca, in Saudi Arabia. My guest is Basharat Peer. He's a Kashmiri journalist, joins us today from New Delhi in India. Wrote a great piece for the New Yorker magazine called Modern Mecca, The Transformation of a Holy City, both about his personal experience of making the Hajj, but also about the landscape of Mecca, forbidden to all but Muslims. Many have that image in mind of the Kaaba at the center of a great sea of pilgrims. He's been there and has come back to tell us about exactly how that feels this day, or these days, I should say. Little sound is here from last year when he was there on the second day of the Hajj pilgrimage. 2.5 million Muslim pilgrims or so gathered on Mount Arafat near Mecca, the place where the Prophet Muhammad is said to have given his last sermon. And it is an enormous, enormous gathering of people just for a week, 5 days. Every year. Last year on the second day of the Hajj, same day, here's a pilgrim talking about why everybody's there.
We are here looking for mercy of Allah, looking for mercy of God. And as you see here, from different countries, different people, different colors, we are coming here to unite.
A voice from last year's Hajj. Basharat Peer in New Delhi, paint this physical topography then today, this urban landscape around the Grand Mosque, and give us some of the history of here. First of all, if you can just start with the Kaaba, what's inside? What happens when people are inside? They're circling around 7 times, I think, and making their way through. What is inside of the Kaaba? What happens there?
Well, Tom, I mean, I think the one of the most powerful moments really is when pilgrims enter the Grand Mosque and you move towards the central courtyard at whose center stands the Kaaba. I mean, just seeing it, as I had earlier said, mm-hmm. it's this sort of dominant image. And, there were thousands of people around me the moment I saw it for the first time. And it's and you carry this small image in your head and then you see it around between 40 and 50 feet tall structure, and you see its drape and this various verses from the Quran, woven into with silk and gold thread on the drape, and it makes this incredibly powerful impression, and a lot of people around me just broke down, and they had like tears in their eyes and they were crying. I was quite moved myself. And there's they say that any prayer you say at the time when you first see the Kaaba is answered. So every person around you is basically raising his hands and trying to, you know, seek what he wants most in the world. And then people move towards it and try to touch the walls of the Kaaba, touch the stones and get close to it, and you keep circling it. And, you know, you don't go inside the Kaaba.
But there's a particular stone everybody wants to...
Of course.
Tell us about that. Malcolm X didn't get to touch it. You didn't get to touch it. There's such a sea of
humanity. That was my consolation. Mm-hmm. So on one of the walls of the Kaaba, there's a stone that's affixed there. It's called the Black Stone. According to Muslim tradition, it fell from heaven. And it was affixed there, and it was a white stone when it fell from heaven, according to Muslim tradition. And over the centuries, it has absorbed the sins of human beings and turned black. So it's known as Black Stone. So at this, it's affixed on a southeastern wall of Kaaba at a particular place, and the Kaaba as we see it today has been rebuilt over the centuries several times, the last time in 1629 by an Ottoman king, because it's the lowest point in this valley of Mecca. It's still to some extent, but it was traditionally surrounded by high hills. There was an entire rim around Kaaba. It's this barren desert valley, but it would be flooded many times. And also the various sectarian battles between early Muslim kings. In those battles, the Kaaba was destroyed several times, and then it was rebuilt. But the time when it was affixed was when it was rebuilt during the life of Prophet Muhammad. His tribe chose him to place the stone in the place where it is today. And before he died, he kissed the stone the last time, and that became a tradition. So every Muslim tries to reach that black stone. It's encased in a silver ring, and it's a hollow. I mean, the touch over centuries has turned it hollow. But everyone tries to get close to it and kiss it. So there's a big crowd there, kind of a mini stampede. And I was like, sure. I mean, I do want to try and, you know, touch it and go close. And I tried several times, but the crush of the crowds always tossed me away. I guess I wasn't strong.
Too much.
it was a bit too much. And also there's the tradition permits that if you can't, I mean, you don't want to push people and use mm-hmm. your elbows right. on a journey like that. Mm-hmm. So you can just salute it from a distance, and that's considered an equivalent. But I was a bit dejected when I couldn't reach there, because, you know, in some ways it's a big part of the journey. And then I was reading this biography of Malcolm X.
And realized you weren't alone.
And I realized I wasn't alone. Malcolm had these beautiful lines saying, you know, just the fervor of the pilgrims and the crowds around it kind of made him decide that, you know, he shouldn't even try it. Right. And that was a great consolation.
We all, Muslim and non-Muslim, have the image of the great sea of humanity around the Kaaba. But there's more to this. There's a lot of walking that goes on. And that goes back to the story of Abraham. And I wish you'd share that with us. This goes back, Abraham, from what? From Judaism and Christianity and Islam, the same Abraham.
Right.
His wife Sarah was unable to conceive. I guess at her request, Abraham taken their female servant Hagar as a second wife. And she bore Abraham a son, Ishmael. Now, that takes us to the story of what's going on with all the walking that goes on by pilgrims on the Hajj.
So, I mean, the story has various versions. I mean, this story has two versions. Like, there's a version in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, and there's a version in the Quran. But since I'm dealing with the Hajj, we'll just stick to the Quranic version,
please.
Which is that God commanded Abraham to, you know, as a test of his faith and the test of faith of his wife Hagar and their child Ishmael, to take them to this desert and leave his wife and child there.
This was a tough God in both traditions, right? Leave them in the desert. Also, you know, in the Old Testament, Abraham and Isaac, you know, did lose the life, take the life of his son. This is a tough challenge.
No, I guess these are divine matters.
Yes.
And so in the Quranic version, so the wife, Abraham leaves his wife and child in at this place, which is sort of there's this barren desert, which is basically very close to where Kaaba stands today. And there are these two small hillocks there. One is called Safa, and another is called Marwa.
Low hills.
And low hills, and she is sort of between these two, and she has a leather bag with some water and some dates. But, you know, they run out of supplies very soon, and Abraham has gone off. And the child is, you know, dying of thirst. And
Ishmael.
Ishmael is really thirsty and crying, and the mother is looking for water. So she starts running between these two low hills, Safa and Marwa, and kind of checking on him, but running between these two hills.
Looking for water, desperately.
A mother desperate to find water for her thirsty child. Mm-hmm. And as she sort of comes back from one hill, and from Marwa, and reaches Ishmael, and she hears a sound. There's this water gurgling under his feet, and she says in her language, Zamzam, which is sort of stop. And
because he's banging his feet on the ground, I guess.
On the ground, on the sand, and there's this water gushing, and then she commands the water to stop, and water stops. And that is what Muslims believe became the source of this well called the Well of Zamzam, and that water is considered holy. And ever since, it has been one of the main sources of water for the town of Mecca, and for pilgrims who have come there throughout ages. And every pilgrim takes back, you know, a few gallons of that water.
And also makes that back and forth between the hills walk.
Yes, and you have to. So after you circle around the Kaaba, you drink a few glasses of Zamzam water, and then the idea is to sort of instill a sense of compassion for the needy and the exiled. And then you have to follow in the steps of Hagar barefoot between those two low hills. I mean, now you don't have that. I mean, you actually don't have that ancient landscape of those two hills out in an open desert. It has all been incorporated in the Grand Mosque. There were various expansions of the Grand Mosque in the post-oil boom era. Mm-hmm. And in one of those expansions, those two hills, low hills, I mean, whatever remained of them, not much, there were some rocks, were incorporated into a wing of the Grand Mosque. And there's a marble floored path between those two hills. Mm-hmm. And it has this multiple, there's three levels. So the path is now built on three levels, and it's air conditioned.
Oh.
And it's covered, but you still have to run barefoot for around 2 miles between these two hills, or where the sort of endpoints of those two hills were at one point.
On three levels, marble floors and AC. We're trying to picture this just to stay entirely up to date here, and all that with a lot of development going on right around the mosque at the same time. Bashar Pir writes about it in The New Yorker, and it's really a compelling telling. Bashar, they're in New Delhi. We've got listeners calling in, would like to join us. If I may, let's begin to go to them. Abdul is calling from Winchester, Virginia. Abdul, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I would like to start with Assalamu alaikum. May peace be unto both of you. Topic on the Mecca and the building of Mecca is the land itself, and I agree. Everything Brother Bashar is saying is exactly right. And the land itself, yes, the Kaaba was built and by Abraham, but the site itself was very sacred from the day of Adam. And the fact that the building that is going on around Kaaba is making it very easier for those who are modern Muslims. Me, I was born and raised in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a, you know, certain type of lifestyle, a type of comfort that's very different from those who are in, per se, Durban, South Africa, you know.
Okay.
And but the fact that coming together in this pilgrimage, it should be kept very simple, because the fact of worshiping God is a very simple attribute. It's a very simple thing to do. And to make this pilgrimage to a land that has so much building and so much excavating and so much taking out, per se, the root of what going to the pilgrimage is about has been severed. But yet it has made it easier for those people like me to actually make the pilgrimage.
In that way, Abdullah, it sounds like many things in modern life may be made easier, but with some of the residents of age lost with that. I appreciate your call. Bashar, describe, if you would, just how much is built around the Grand Mosque now, just what Abdul's referring to.
Sure.
That you describe yourself averting your face from because it was interfering with your sense of pilgrimage.
It does. You know, I understand the concerns people have for comfort, but, you know, sort of going on a pilgrimage of this sort, is comfort is not, I think, foremost on anybody's mind. And it's also sort of an exercise kind of in egalitarianism, which is one of the core ideals of Islam, I mean, or was supposed to be. I mean, so you have a lot of 1%, 99% coming into that story there. So there is a lot of, there are various tower blocks and hotels built just around the Kaaba, and the biggest one, which is very close to the Kaaba. I mean, it's, I think, less than a distance of it's one block, really, a New York block, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's just this, it's the second tallest building in the world. It is, you know, the Grand Mosque, we all see the pictures. There are these minarets of the Kaaba,
sure,
of the Grand Mosque,
mm-hmm,
and then you see the tower. It's
dwarfing them.
It's completely dwarfing the entire complex. I mean, if you look at the Kaaba from a top floor room in the tower, it looks like a matchbox.
And what's in this tower?
It's Herald Square Macy's, and you know, it's one of the biggest shopping malls I have ever seen, and it has you know, there are bags. You can buy Prada. You can buy all the designer clothes
and hotels,
Benetton, and then there's a massive food court, and then there are these super luxury hotels, which, you know, there are five hotels all put together. They can accommodate 60,000 pilgrims.
A fraction of those who come, many stay
which is
elsewhere.
A small fraction of those who come, and these are extremely expensive. I mean, when I looked at the rates, I mean, it's rather insane. I mean, one of the crown, the jewel in the crown, is this hotel called Fairmont Mecca Clock Tower Hotel, and the business executive is there when I went to meet them, and they give you their business cards, and it says the destination for a divine stay, and the rooms there are graded in three tiers. I mean, there are some rooms which have a view of the Kaaba, so you can have your cup of coffee, look out of the window, and look at the Kaaba. And then there are those which look at parts of the Grand Mosque. And there are those which they describe as looking out onto the Holy City. And the rates of a double room with a view of the Kaaba range from $1,100 to $4,500 a night when I tried booking something on their website. And, you know, that is sort of more than what most Muslims make in a year.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Muslims making the Hajj and how the holy pilgrimage ground is being remade in Mecca. Basharat Peer joins us from New Delhi in India. He went on the Hajj last year. Quite a writer himself, author of Curfew Night, and currently working on a book about India's Muslims titled Shadow of the Broken Dome. He wrote a big piece for the New Yorker magazine about his own experience of making the Hajj, the spiritual experience, the physical experience, and how that landscape is being transformed by the development. You can link to the piece at our website, onpointradio.org. Joins us from New Delhi. Bashar, you say it's interesting, all the ways in which Saudi culture is being expressed in Mecca these days. Of course, for a long time, it was the Ottoman Empire that ruled here. But now under the Saudis, you quote Ziauddin Sardar, British writer on Islam, saying that the Saudis are technological determinists. In their worldview, everything old is bad, while everything new, everything involving technology, is good. And you see that very much on display here, Bashar.
Tom, I do agree with Ziauddin. I mean, though there's a very, very tiny minority of Saudi critics of this sort of kind of blind embrace of modernity and, turbocharged development around in this ancient city. I mean, you do get the sense that everything that's sort of sacred has been profaned. And the big changes really came after, after the oil crisis in, 1970s. And when the OPEC was formed and the oil revenues really rushed. I mean, it wasn't even, the changes were underway earlier after the oil boom and the money started trickling in and modern Saudi Arabia started changing. But it was really in the early 70s as the oil revenues jumped immensely that the House of Saud set about to modernize the holy places and the rest of the country too. So in the other Muslim holy city of Medina, it was again like layers and layers of history, but they were all wiped away, destroyed, and new buildings of a certain style built. And that's exactly what has happened in Mecca too. So the earlier, you had a lot of beautiful Ottoman structures, and there was also, there were various other influences too from the Muslim world on the architecture, and they had rather elegant houses in Mecca. Mm. I mean, mostly stone houses with these really ornate and rather beautiful, wooden windows called mashrabiyas.
Lattice work
windows that jutted out and had these geometrical or floral designs. And from the pictures and accounts of earlier travelers, I mean, they were very pleasing, very beautiful.
To be fair, if I may, Bashar, to the Saudis, you describe yourself how some have seen too much interest even in saving old buildings as a kind of idolatry. They've said, look, the point is all about the religious experience, not the buildings around it. Did I read you correctly?
I mean, I think you can't have religious experience in a vacuum, There is cultural history. There's a certain landscape. I mean, if you go to Mecca and you ask people, what is Mecca really famous for? Well, there's the Kaaba, and the Prophet Muhammad was born there and lived there. So you would ask, okay, where did the Prophet live? Or you would ask questions about his life. Mm-hmm. How did this man who sort of brought Islam to the world that, Muslims see as their prophet and like, how did he live his life in Mecca? Where did he go? So there are very few remnants of that history, of that landscape. The house in which he was born, I mean, the Ottomans had still maintained it. They had a certain sense of history. But under the Saudi rule, it was basically, because they were, Saudis came into power with the help of this puritanical preacher, Abdul Wahhab, and that's where the Wahhabism comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And they just see anything that's associated to a person's biography as something that could lead to idolatrous practices,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't necessarily have to be the case. So the house in which the Prophet was born was demolished. They turned it into a cattle market. I saw it right now. I went, when I was on the Hajj, I saw the site. It's a tiny public library they have built, and they have put these big billboards, I mean, sort of like news stickers that we see, on various public squares, uh-huh. like the big news stickers at the sort of...
A news ticker, yes, sure.
Like, it runs like that and it says, there's no proof that Prophet Muhammad was born here.
And that's a kind of Wahhabi position.
That is the Wahhabi position. Mm-hmm. So what you do find there is this mixture of love for modern technology and Wahhabism coming together and kind of completely changing the landscape of this ancient city.
with the second tallest building in the world, just a block from the Grand Mosque, the images we've all seen. Let's go to our callers, if I may. Basharat Peer joins us from New Delhi. In Buffalo, New York, Ashraf is calling. Ashraf, thanks. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Assalamu alaikum, Bashar.
My
point is that the belief in the Muslim religion of our creation is that we are here to worship God, one, and two, to build or develop the earth. And I believe that all the buildings and all the development that's taking place around the Kaaba is kind of standing proof when people go to Hajj to tell God, we are doing our job. This is, we're doing what you sent us to do. We're worshiping you, and we are building the earth. And with the, in regards to technology, science is extremely emphasized in Islam. And the first word in the Holy Quran that was revealed was the word read. And just all the technological advances that you see around the Kaaba is kind of, again, it's just a record of our achievements that God has sent us to accomplish.
Ashraf, I appreciate that perspective. Let us pick it up. Basharat, what do you say?
Well, I do agree with that, with the statement that, you know, the first revelation in the Quran was read, Ikra. So, yes, there is emphasis on reading. There's emphasis, there's a saying of the Prophet that it's, you know, incumbent on all Muslim men and women to set out in the pursuit of knowledge, even if you have to go as far as China. And, but, you know, there is reading of all kinds. And, you know, Robert Moses did read, and Jane Jacobs did read too. And urban planning and cultural studies and a study of architectural heritage is also part of reading and part of the curriculum. So I wouldn't just go with a certain selective set of readings.
But, and you make a deeper critique. I've seen you interviewed saying that what you see is the inequality in what you call hyper-commercialization of Mecca today goes against the very core of Islamic ideals of egalitarianism. You've said Prophet Muhammad wouldn't approve of what you see in Mecca today. That's pretty tough.
Well, it is the core of, you know, I mean, egalitarianism does, I mean, remain at the core of Islam, I mean, apart from everything else as sort of an ideal. And what you do have is these are all these towers employing all the most modern technology. They only serve a very small fraction of Muslims who come for the Hajj, the wealthiest of the wealthiest.
Yeah.
And then just elsewhere, I mean, I went to the other quarters too, and right outside these big towers in courtyards and on empty streets, on empty spaces between the fancy Hilton Mecca and the, you know, Mecca Tower clocks, Fairmont and other hotels, or Intercontinental, there were hundreds of, you know, believers who were sleeping on the streets. They were construction workers or from Africans, Asians who couldn't afford, and they were believers too, but they had nowhere to go.
Irfan is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Irfan, you're on the air.
Peace be upon all of you.
Thanks.
Basically, my point here is that we have to adapt to modern technology, we have to adapt to science. But at the same time, as Basharat is making a point, that I was reading actually A History of Jerusalem by Karen Armstrong, and she mentions that even historically, 1,000 years before, there were actually temples, churches, or masjids were not allowed to build higher than the main structure of the religion. And my point here is that the hyper-commercialization of his Mecca is necessary, but at the same time, there has to be an accommodation of 99%.
Yeah, some accommodation, you say, Irfan. Let us hold that thought and get one more. I appreciate your call. Wahiba is calling from Boston. Wahiba, you're on the air.
Hi. I totally agree with Mr. Bashar. I'm originally from Algeria.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't born here in the United States.
Okay.
2 years ago, both my parents went to Arabia Saudi for the pilgrimage, and it was totally different what they did imagine. They had a feeling that going to the pilgrimage didn't make them equal. Like, they had a feeling that there is always a rich people and a poor people. But that wasn't a point of a pilgrimage. A pilgrimage should be, everybody should have a same living way during the religious.
While they're on the pilgrimage, they should be at the same level as one people, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, because it's all they were all doing it for the sake of God. It was all for our religion. Then why there are hotels that you have to pay from $1,100 to $4,500 a night? It seems like it's all about business and money, and this is what they did notice too. Everything is more expensive during that period. In Saudi Arabia, and this is, it doesn't seem right. It doesn't feel right.
Wahiba, I'm grateful for your call as well. I mean, to look back, remember the history. 1979, you had the mosque, the Grand Mosque, seized by critics of the Saudi royal family, Bashar. And the critique was something along these lines, right? Critiquing an obsession with wealth.
Yes, Tom. In 1979, there were these millenarian terrorists, and they seized the Grand Mosque. But among the various criticisms they made, one of the things they wanted was, like, Saudi Arabia should not have any dealings with the United States. And they just said, you should not deal with infidels. Mm. And then the larger and more elaborate points they were making was about this kind of obsession with wealth and greed and commercialization. And when, after a very bloody siege, these people, a lot of these terrorists were killed, and a lot of them were arrested, and they were put on trial. And a mufti, who later on became the Grand Mufti, Sheikh Al-Baz, a very orthodox preacher who became the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, he was to read the verdict of their sentencing to death. And when he did read the verdict, he was completely in agreement with all their charges about commercialization and obsession with money and greed, and except that he said, essentially, in Wahhabi Islam, you cannot disobey your ruler. And they had also claimed that, you know, sort of like the idea of resurrection, Muslims talk about, you know, the Redeemer as Mahdi. And they, one of the sort of the lead terrorists, Juhayman Utaybi's brother-in-law, he was described as the Redeemer, that he's reborn now, mm-hmm. and he will
Redeemer.
Save the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the preacher who sentenced them to death said that those were the only two mistakes you made: disobeying your leader, which is the ruler of mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. and calling this guy the Redeemer. But he did not disagree with them on the other charges. So these criticisms have been made by people of very, very different, you know, political understandings and orientations. But you do feel it very acutely there that, you know, that the investments are largely made in the direction of wherein you're creating infrastructure for the super rich and not really doing much in terms of housing arrangements or infrastructure for people who can't afford that kind
and
of work.
Interestingly, these waves of rebuilding, many of them carried out by the Bin Laden group, the huge, of course, construction group there on the Arabian Peninsula, and including another huge further extension. The Saudi Bin Laden group plans to finish by 2020, you write, to the Grand Mosque, right in the middle of all of it. In spite of all that, I read you here at the center of all this, Bashar, if I read you correctly, still having a kind of moment of sense of great unity, something almost ecstatic for a moment there.
Oh, it is. I mean, certainly. I mean, for me, the big moments there is when you arrive there and you enter the Grand Mosque and you see the Kaaba and you look at, you know, this, I've never seen anything like this. Everyone, all races, colors, dressed in white. And
genders.
What strikes you,
women are
and
in
genders,
the thick
women
of this.
And men, mm-hmm. Women and men, it's the only prominent mosque in the world where men and women are allowed to worship together. And I'm walking with these people, and I hear, you know, I mean, I lived in New York City for a long time, so I was used to all kinds of, you know, people from every part of the world. But then you suddenly hear this particular prayer or a line from Quran being said out in 30, 40 different accents at the same time. And it's quite fascinating. And then in a later part of the journey, when you move out of Mecca, in the later part of the pilgrimage, to the to the plains of Arafat, which is the main day of the Hajj, where, you know, every pilgrim on the Hajj has to assemble in this massive plain and pray together and ask for forgiveness. I mean, you just walk for miles and miles among in an ocean of people, just wearing these white robes. You don't know anyone, and people are just, you know, they just stop and they think you are thirsty. They give you a bottle of water. Somebody walks up to you, gives you some oranges. I was, after a long walk, walking several miles, I was extremely hungry, and there was a Saudi man standing by the street, and he sees me and like gave me a plate of rice and chicken and says, "Eat it," and didn't ask me for money. So you see these acts of generosity and sort of this very moving sense of being part of a multitude, kind of being part of a whole world.
All that plus a new world being built up around it at the same time, and no sign of that slowing down. You say it will look like Dubai.
I fear so.
Asharat Peer, we're grateful to you for your good and observant eye and for your generosity in sharing this description of the experience and the physical place with us. It's great of you to join us from New Delhi today. We're grateful for it and for your piece, Shadow of the Broken Dome, coming out, your book coming out next year, and for your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom. It was a joy.
Modern Mecca, Asharat Peer's piece in The New Yorker. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook.